From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We think of ancient tales coming down to us like nature, organic and full-born. Well, yes and no. Without Homer, what would we know of Troy? And then there's the Norse vein, the hammer-wielding Thor, the one-eyed king Odin, shapeshifters, dwarves, wizards, warriors, the Viking sagas. You can thank one vivid storyteller from medieval Iceland for an awful lot of that. This hour On Point, mythic storytelling in the Norse vein, and the man who made it. You can join the conversation. Can you see the taproot here of Tolkien and Wagner and Neil Gaiman? The streams that flow to Blake and Longfellow, Seamus Heaney, Gunter Grass. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Norwich, Vermont, is Nancy Marie Brown. She's a writer and scholar of Icelandic literature and culture, author of The Far Traveler, Voyages of a Viking Woman, and A Good Horse Has No Color, Searching Iceland for the Perfect Horse, now Song of the Vikings, Snorri, and the Making of Norse Myths. Nancy Marie Brown, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you.
Thanks for having me, Tom. So delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. I guess we all know a lot. Just atmospherically about this, whether we care about these or not, there's so much a part of our culture. I had no idea that it went back so much to one man. You describe this guy standing on a pier in Norway back in the years of Saladin and Genghis Khan and Francis of Assisi. We're back in the 1200s here, and there's a guy named Snorri, and is he really the spigot through which all this Norse mythology and even pagan religion nearly flows, that Tolkien and Blake and all the rest?
As far as we can tell, he is. He is the only source for most of these tales that we know of as Norse mythology. There is a few poems, but if we didn't have Snorri's own tales with, you know, their endings, their explanations, the characterizations, we wouldn't really be able to understand the poems. We have some rune stones that give us pictures, but again, you can see a picture of an eight-legged horse, but if you didn't know that Snorri tells us that Odin has a famous horse with eight legs, you wouldn't know that the rider was Odin. There's no other source for so many of these tales that we think of as classic Norse literature.
So you describe this moment where here he is, he's an Icelander, very much so, and he's got a whole history there. It's not all pretty, but it's very, very colorful. He's in Norway. There's a very young king there, 14 years old, and this young Norwegian king is reading the story of King Arthur sent over to him by a 10-year-old king in England. And I guess Snorri gets upset that this Norwegian king is reading tales from elsewhere and not enough of his own.
That's the way I see it, Tom. In Icelandic history, Norwegian history, you've had this position of being the king's skald, the king's poet, the court poet. And it was a position of so much importance for about 400 years. The poet was considered the best ambassador, the first counselor of the king. He was the one who established the virtues and the values of the Viking world. And Snorri expected to be named to this position when he came over from Iceland in 1218, because everybody knew that Icelanders were the best poets back then. Mm. And here he's confronted with this 14-year-old king who thinks that the stories of King Arthur, which was all the rage in Europe at that time, was much more interesting than these old poems about the Viking kings Olaf and Harald. And I mean, in some ways, he was right, because the poetry is very difficult to understand if you don't know the background, if you haven't been properly educated.
But he sets his would-be king's poet off on a just incredible jag of storytelling, gathering all this together, actually writing down on parchment.
Yes, he did. He had been collecting poems and memorizing poems since he was a boy. He really loved these old Viking poems. And so he first tried to impress the young king by writing the best skaldic poem ever written. It's 100 stanzas long, and each stanza is in a different poetic form. Now, you have to think of these poems of having all kinds of rules and regulations. It's worse than a haiku. It's worse than a sonnet. What order you put the words in, how you use rhyme, how you use alliteration. So he has this tour de force 100 stanza poem, which is essentially praising the young king and saying what a great king he is. And it's totally dull when you read it now, because I mean, you just don't understand what is poetic about it. When you actually boil it down to a translation, you get like a whole stanza will say, a good king defends his land. Okay, well, that's really exciting. But what made these poems work were all the allusions to the old stories. So, for instance, a Viking poet, a skaldic poet, would never use the word gold. He would always say Sif's hair or Freya's tears or Otter's ransom. Mm. And, you know, he'll just drop that into a poem, and you're supposed to call up the story in your mind of why is gold called Sif's hair and why is gold called Otter's ransom? Mm. Freya's tears is kind of easy because Freya is the goddess of love and she's so beautiful that even her tears are little droplets of gold. But the other two, it's a bit of a stretch. And when these poems were written, there obviously was a story explaining it. But that story wasn't remembered very well.
So here comes Snorri. He brings it all back.
Here comes Snorri.
And with a power. I mean, we'll look at the sort of knock-on effect down through history. But you've got a reading I want to sneak in here before our first break. Take it fast forward to the 1920s, and you've got, well, you'll hear a couple of rather well-known writers here. Dive right in from your preface, if you would, Nancy.
Okay. In the late 1920s, J.R.R. Tolkien provoked an argument. Opposing him, among others, was C.S. Lewis. Tolkien had not yet written The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings. Lewis had not yet written The Chronicles of Narnia. They were debating the appropriate curriculum for English majors at Oxford University, where they both taught. Tolkien believed that too much time was spent on dull and unimportant writers like Shakespeare, whom Lewis revered. Instead, Tolkien thought, students should read Snorri Sturluson. Who? And not only Snorri, but the other fine authors of the Icelandic sagas and the Eddic poems, and the students should read them in Old Norse. Lewis had read the mythological tales from Snorri's Edda in English as a boy. He found the Norse myths more compelling as stories, he said, than even the Bible. Like Tolkien, he was drawn to their northernness, to their depiction of dragons and dwarves, fair elves and werewolves, wandering wizards and trolls that turned to stone, to their portrayal of men with a bitter courage who stood fast on the side of right and good, even when there was no hope at all. It's even better in the original, Tolkien said. He had been reading Old Norse since his teens. He loved the cold, crisp, unsentimental language of the sagas, their bare, straightforward tone like wind keening over the ice. Reading Snorri and his peers was more important than reading Shakespeare, Tolkien argued, because their books were more central to our language and our modern world. Egg, ugly, ill, smile, knife, fluke, fellow, husband, birth, death, take, mistake, lost, skulk, ransack, brag, and law, among many other common English words, all derive from Old Norse. As for Snorri's effect on modernity, it was soon to mushroom. Tolkien convinced his colleagues to substitute Snorri for Shakespeare by starting a club called the Kolbiter. A coalbiter, in the sagas, is a lad who lounges by the fire instead of working. Roused, he transforms into a hero, an outlaw, or both. These academic coalbiters lounged by the fire, translating medieval Icelandic poetry and prose aloud. They began with the myths in Snorri's Edda. A few years later, having finished the major Icelandic sagas and the mythological verse in the poetic Edda, the club morphed into the Inklings, where they read their own works. One of those works was The Hobbit.
Nancy Marie Brown reading from her new book, Song of the Vikings, and off we go. I mean, you go Hobbit, you go Tolkien, you go Wagner, you go so much of contemporary entertainments, storytelling, and fantasy, and not only contemporary. I mean, you sort of list of influenced by here, by the tales, the Norse tales that came down compliments of Snorri on your list, just among William Blake, Sir Walter Scott, Thomas Carlyle, Longfellow, Tennyson, I mean, Ibsen, Thomas Hardy, Tolkien, of course, Gunter Grass, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Ursula Le Guin, Seamus Heaney, Jane Smiley, Neil Gaiman, Michael Chabon. I mean, you've got a big list that you say
you
live in the wake.
To that. You could add to that almost indefinitely. I started after I finished the book keeping a little file called Odd Norse References where I'd put in another thing I was reading and suddenly there's a reference to Valhalla or a reference to the Valkyries. And one of the more recent was Ivan Doig's book, The Bartender's Tale, where he has a tree named Yggdrasil that, you know, is very important to the plot of the story. And if you don't know what this means,
it's not just particular characters. It's a kind of way of looking at the world.
It is.
And what is that?
Well, it's very funny. You were talking about trolls earlier in your program, and I never knew that an internet troll actually came from a fishing metaphor, which you earlier. And I've always thought of the internet trolls as being these lumpy giant type creatures from Norse mythology who turn to stone when they're hit by sunlight.
They do look that way too, coming up from under the bridge and boom.
Exactly. And in The Hobbit, that's where Tolkien got that idea of trolls turning to stone. And, of course, you know, Tolkien says, as we all know, trolls turn to stone. And that hadn't been common in England.
That whole vein of storytelling, so wide and so influential and so present with us now. Behind us here, a little music from the Icelandic band Sigur Rós. Nancy Marie Brown is with us. Her new book is Song of the Vikings, Snorri, and the Making of Norse Myths. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about mythic storytelling out of Iceland, the roots of Gandalf and Wagner and Tolkien and maybe some Michael Chabon and the old Norse tales of a frozen island. Nancy Marie Brown is with us. Her new book is Song of the Vikings, Snorri, S-N-O-R-R-I, The Making of Norse Myths. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Nancy, when you were reading about Tolkien there and C.S. Lewis going back and forth, but I mean, these very characters and the terrain itself comes straight into the world of Tolkien.
I think so. When I first went to Iceland, I wondered why it seems so familiar. I mean, I thought, what, have I lived in a former life in Iceland? And then I realized that Tolkien had been so very much inspired by William Morris's journals of travels in Iceland in 1870. And he had taken the landscape of Iceland and turned it into Middle Earth, which is also an Icelandic term.
The wastes, even Mordor itself, this volcanic.
Mordor itself. I mean, really, I've seen a volcano erupt in Iceland, and you just can't help but think of Mordor and the Dark Lord Sauron when you see that happening.
And the names. You've got Gandalf there in Snorri. You've got Durin, and on it goes.
Well, that was what keyed me into the idea in the beginning. I had been a Tolkien fan since I think I was 4 years old. And when I was in college in the 1970s, you didn't really admit to being a fan of Tolkien or fantasy writing if you were in the English department. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was escapist fiction. You weren't supposed to say that Tolkien was your favorite writer, and he was. And I'm taking this class in comparative mythology, and they have us read the prose Edda by Snorri Sturluson. And I started recognizing names out of it. Biffer, Baffer, Nori, Ori, Owen, Thorin Oakenshield, and Gandalf.
Yeah.
And, okay, what is Tolkien's wizard doing in medieval Iceland? So this is in 1977 that I start making this connection, and then I learned about Tolkien's biography. I read his letters. I learned how interested he was in Icelandic literature, how he taught Icelandic literature. He translated. And then I went to Iceland, and I just started seeing the connections there and realized how much this little island in the North Atlantic has influenced our modern culture. I mean, it just hits you over and over again when you see dwarves and elves and wizards in all of our board games and our role-playing games and
our movies
online
and our video
games and movies. I mean, the recent movie Thor. You wouldn't have Thor if you didn't have Snorri Sturluson.
That's kind of incredible. I mean, we thought of it as mythology that everybody knew, and so it just came up in some organic folk way, but it goes back to him when he was writing on parchment. How did that survive, or did it, the originals, survive?
The originals did not survive. The oldest manuscripts we have are from about 50 or 60 years after he died. So that's pretty close for medieval literature. And he didn't invent the gods. He didn't invent Thor and Odin. It's just that it had been 200 years since anybody had worshipped them. So the whole idea of their character.
Because Christianity had come to the north, Scandinavia.
Christianity had come to the north, yes. Christianity came to Britain and Ireland much earlier than it did to Scandinavia. And the Vikings, as you know, traded with Britain and Ireland and Northern Europe. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm focusing on the trading part, but we all know they also pillaged and burned and raided and, you know, all that kind of Viking stuff that we've heard about. But there was a lot of cross-fertilization. So they had known about Christianity, and Vikings had been Christian themselves since the settlement of Iceland in the 870s. And we're talking about 1220 in Iceland. So there was a long time that they had been influenced by a Christian religion, that they had been Christian themselves. The country became Christian by a parliamentary act in the year 1000. And it wasn't really proper to be talking about, you know, the gods and the giants.
Pagan days.
Pagan days, pagan rituals and all that. And when you see the way Snorri wrote it, he was interested in preserving the poetry, in preserving the culture, but not offending the church. He was Christian himself. He was church educated. His patron, his hopeful patron, the 14-year-old king of Norway, had been educated by bishops. He was very strict. And so Snorri turns these tales, these myths, these ideas into very funny stories. I mean, almost obscenely funny sometimes. Within the amount of adolescent humor that there is in the originals is just, you know, mind-boggling.
Well, look at
a
that
lot
humor.
Of times these these stories are retold for children, and they take all that stuff out.
Yeah, but, well, it's pretty good though. We'll look at the humor and the guy who wrote it. But read a little more just to give us a sense of how many of these names and notions, how thoroughly infused. I mean, it is hard to imagine, as you write this here, it is hard to imagine the fantasy life of the Western world, at this point the world, without the spigot, the funnel of Snorri sort of grabbing all what was old then and making it for a moment new again, and then what looks like maybe eternal. Read a bit for us more.
Oh, I hope eternal, yeah. Okay, so I'm going to read this passage. Viking poems often allude to legends and myths, so Snorri included many such tales in his Edda. All the stories we know of the Vikings' pagan religion, the Norse myths of Valhalla and the Valkyries, of elves and dwarves and dragons, of one-eyed Odin and the Well of Wisdom, of red-bearded Thor and his hammer of might, of two-faced Loki and the death of beautiful Balder, of lovesick Freyr and lovely Freya, the rainbow bridge, the great ash tree Yggdrasil, the world-wrapping Midgard serpent, Heimdall's horn, the eight-legged horse Sleipnir, Ragnarok, or the twilight of the gods. All the stories we know of the gods whom we still honor with the names Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. For all these stories, Snorri is our main and sometimes our only source. Introducing the 1954 translation of Snorri's Edda, an Icelandic scholar remarked that no one now read it as a textbook on mythology. He was wrong. All textbooks on Norse mythology rely on Snorri's creation. There's little else to go on. We have poems containing cryptic hints. We have runestones whose blunt images and few words tantalize. Only Snorri gives us stories, with beginnings and endings and explanations. Our modern understanding of the ancient Scandinavian belief system, and especially what a 1909 translator calls its peculiar grim humor, is a product of Snorri's imagination.
The peculiar grim humor and sometimes very, very broad humor. Nancy Marie Brown reading from her book, Song of the Vikings. All that through this spigot, this funnel, this Icelander from the 13th century. Roy's calling from Buffalo. Hi, Roy. You're on the air with Nancy Marie Brown.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for another really interesting show. I just wanted to chime in that I spent part of my childhood in Sweden at the edge of a large university town. And around 1970, 71, ordinary Swedes would refer to the Nisse, the little people who live under rocks and stumps in the woods, as a normal presence in life. Your cat disappears, well, you know, maybe it went after the Nisse's killed children and they got rid of it.
Yeah.
And this wasn't just to me as a child. I could hear adults do this to each other. And people had this kind of literature available around them. It was ordinary to have these books around. people would refer to this stuff.
Absolutely. Roy, if I may, let us pick up how that might or might not filter back to Snorri in Iceland here. I mean, Nancy, did survive the great, transition to Christianity and stay in folk culture in Scandinavia through all those years, all the dwarves and elves and little people in the woods? Or did Snorri really bring that back, or did it live always?
Well, I can't say whether it lived always, because that's a long time. It is there now in Iceland. There is still the sense of the people who live in the rocks, the people who live in the hills. They're not all little people. The elves are the hidden folk, especially in Snorri's version, were tall and beautiful and immortal, could easily marry humans. They're much more like the elves in Tolkien's world than they are, you know, little fairies or gnomes.
But the dwarves, I think I read somewhere in your work about them predating men, them coming up out of the earth earlier.
Well, that's the story that Snorri tells in the creation of the world. He starts from the beginning when there was nothing, but the dwarves were created out of maggots, which is not very nice.
You got to come from somewhere if you want to live.
Like maggots growing in the earth or something like that, and then they were given the shapes of people and understanding, but they still lived in rocks, and they're known as being incredible workers, smiths. They were the source of technology in the stories that Snorri tells, the ships and the weapons and the wonderful conveyances like the boar that can fly through the air and shine in the darkness.
I guess I'm still just wondering, having heard the same kind of stories as our caller from Buffalo of the little people in the woods, whether that may have been fading away along with the pagan era when Snorri was alive, or whether
it could have been.
Because in his campfire.
In his History of the Kings of Norway, which is his second most important book, the Heimskringla, he tells a lot of these folk tales of a certain king who was coming past a large stone at night, and there was someone standing there saying, "Would you like to visit the Hall of Odin?" And he said, "Yeah, I'd like to visit the Hall of Odin." And he goes into the rock and he disappears forever. So Snorri includes that sort of folk tale also in his stories. He may have been the one who preserved much of it, but we really don't know how much of these stories grew out of the storytelling tradition that was alive in Iceland throughout the Middle Ages and into, the 19th and 20th century, of people making up stories about these sorts of supernatural creatures. And I'm sure the same is true in Scandinavia, proper, in Norway and Sweden, that people just like to tell stories. The nights are very dark and very long.
Pitch
and it's a good way.
Yeah, pitch it forward. The epic battles, the sort of fiery crevasse, the ring, so much that shows up in Tolkien and elsewhere, we'll look at that, it comes almost straight out of the texture of Snorri's stories.
Yeah, it really does. It really does. I was disappointed when Peter Jackson set his films in New Zealand, because really they ought to be in Iceland, but I understand why he decided to do that.
I mean, the final battle idea, for example, very Norse idea that the end of the world will come and we'll fight to the end even if the odds are absolutely overwhelming.
Well, that was what Tolkien really saw in the Norse myths that was so incredibly poignant, is that the gods know from the beginning that there will be a last battle and that they will fight the fire giants and the frost ogres and the serpent that encircles the ocean, and that they will lose. They know from the beginning that they will lose, and so they go into battle shoulder to shoulder, armed only with their knowledge that they are doing what is right. And Tolkien himself, fought in World War I and saw some of that courage in getting out of the trenches and going across no man's land when your chances
courage
of making
and horror.
It to the other side. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And a lot of what Tolkien was writing is an anti-war book, but you can also see that even back in Snorri's day, that was sort of an anti-war book. You're going to lose. Those giants are really big.
But it can be taken
really
the
tough.
Other way. I mean, Wagner picked all this up in a big way. We heard Twilight of the Gods in there.
Right,
Hitler
right.
picked it up. I had no idea, but you describe versions of this being handed out to Hitler youth before
World
War II.
This is really scary. I mean, you can't blame Snorri for who uses his work after he's dead for 800 years. But in Germany, this was... The heart of German nationalism was the idea of folklore. And if you have folklore, you have to have a folk. You have to have a group of people with the same stories and values and ideas. And the Grimm brothers, to Grimm's fairy tales, they chose Snorri's work to represent Germanic folklore. And they're the ones who called it Germanic first. I mean, I kind of have a problem with that. I think it should be called Icelandic or Norse or Scandinavian, but it is known as Germanic mythology because of the brothers Grimm. And in the nationalist period in Germany, they took these ideas of the bold, blonde, you know, laugh in the face of death Viking that Snorri writes about in Heimskringla, his history of the kings of Norway, and those become the Nazis. And they take the ideas of the greedy dwarf live in the dark, and those, in Wagner's version at least, become, you know, very Jewish kind of dwarves.
Though in Snorri the original, those are two sides of the same coin, the same people, his own people.
Are exactly that. They are two sides of the same coin. The dwarves are not the bad guys. The gods are not the good guys. The Vikings, the way he established the archetype of the Viking, which is the image that we still use today in our sports teams and all that, was you had the big blonde hero, but you also had the dark, sometimes ugly and misshapen, intelligent, crafty wizard, poet, maybe even shapeshifter. Some of these guys are werewolves, and they're They're the ones who succeed. Is in some of his stories are the dark ones, the small ones, the smart ones, and even in one of the sagas that writes about Snorri as a person himself, he comes across as more of one of these tricky, sly, crafty, you know, forked tongue sorts of characters.
Tolkien was furious with the way the Nazis had embraced and kind of tarnished this.
Absolutely. He sort of had a mission to reclaim Icelandic literature for the English canon, because you remember the Anglo-Saxons were, you know, the Old English, and Old English and Old Norse are very, very close languages. They could understand each other back then. And if you think of Beowulf as being our classic Old English story, well, it's actually about a bunch of Danes, about a bunch of Vikings. Mm. And there's a dragon in that too. And Tolkien just loved Beowulf. He loved the Icelandic sagas. He loved Snorri Sturluson's works. And he thought they should be part of the curriculum in English because, as I mentioned in my first reading, so much of our language comes from Norse. So much of our idea of liberty comes from Icelandic sagas, and the idea of the freedom of the individual, all of this is brought out in the sagas. And so Tolkien started teaching it and started convincing the Department of English at Oxford to include Snorri instead of some of those many, many hours of boring Shakespeare that people had to suffer through.
Nancy, stand by. Nancy Marie Brown is with us. Her book is Song of the Vikings, Snorri and the Making of Norse Myths. Of course, it came into Wagner as well. We'll look at that behind us here. His first in the Ring Cycle, Der Ring des Nibelungen. Wagner, back to Snorri. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about mythic storytelling out of Iceland, the roots of Gandalf, Wagner, Tolkien, and maybe some Michael Chabon in the old Norse tales of a frozen island. Nancy Marie Brown is with us today. Her new book is Song of the Vikings, Snorri and the Making of Norse Myths. The legacy very, very wide indeed, as Nancy Marie Brown describes it, certainly up to and including Tolkien's fantasy works. Here's a scene from the 2002 film, Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings, Two Towers. Aragorn welcomes a large group of Norse-like elves offering their services in battle.
An alliance once existed between elves and men. Long ago we fought and died together. We come to honor that allegiance.
Mangovanin. You are most welcome.
It's not all so high blown here. 2011, the Marvel film Thor. First, Thor.
You. What realm is this? Alfheim? Dornheim?
New Mexico?
You dare threaten me, Thor, with so puny a weapon?
What? He was freaking me out!
Thor gets tasered in the 2011 film there. Thor, Marvel film. Camille's calling from Frankfurt, Michigan. Camille, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Nancy.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What fun to tune in today and see who you have for your guest. I first discovered all of these, the Norse myths and all of this, when I got my training as a Waldorf teacher. And you know, having grown up in an Italian-American home, this was really a different color, and I loved it. And as a linguist, I love it, too, because of as your guest was saying, all the words in our language that come from the Norse. And I just wondered if your guest knew that the Yggdrasil tree, the Kalevala, Beowulf, all of these things are taught in the fourth grade of the Waldorf curriculum throughout this country and Europe. It's not just this one. I mean, they teach different creation myths and, you know, the Greek, about the Greek gods and all of that. But fourth grade is fairly dedicated to the Norse myths.
Boom. There they come.
Oh, that's wonderful.
At an age when children no doubt adore them. And what's the reason? Just to round out the picture of the world? Or is there something more than that, Camille?
It's definitely that, but it's because it gives them, it nourishes their imaginations and helps them develop tools, courage, all of the things that they need to be able to negotiate the world. And at 10 years old, 9 and 10 years old, these are the stories that are most nourishing to them. And at different grades, they are taught different stories.
Camille, I love the update there on the curriculum. What do you think of that, Nancy? What is that, about 10 years old?
Yeah, I think it's just perfect because it's exactly what Snorri was hoping would happen when he put these stories down on parchment. He was hoping that the 14-year-old king of Norway would pick up these Viking virtues of courage and, you know, hope and inspiration and all that. And it didn't really happen. But here, you know, 800 years later, we're using them in America, which is just really terrific.
We've got very contemporary figures in literature. Michael Chabon was with us just recently, and you describe him reading these early on.
Yeah, he actually wrote the introduction to a new edition of the Norse myths that was illustrated by the wonderful illustrators, a couple called Dolaire. And he admits in the beginning that that these stories had had such an effect on him as a writer in their use of mockery and self-mockery and silliness to talk about very, very deep and important issues. I mean, you don't generally make fun of your gods, but when you do, you remember those stories an awful lot more.
And what about the grim humor? You talk about the broad humor, but also there's this grim quality.
Yeah, you have I kind of like to think about Thor when I think about the humorous aspects. And I think your clip from the movie gave that sense of his character just perfectly. He's really a big, dumb ox, and he's always kind of being made fun of slyly by Loki the trickster and Odin, and they get into some of these, you know, escapades, and Thor always, you know, gets everyone out of it by bashing a giant on the head. But for instance, Loki also gets the gods out of trouble in his little sly way when Odin's not there. One of my favorites is when he has to turn himself into a mare and lead off the giant's stallion.
Let's go this way.
Yeah, they kind of take out the obscene parts of this when they're telling it for children, yeah. But this is a mare in heat, and the stallion just loves the smell of this, and they run off, and the giant is supposed to be building a wall around Valhalla, and he has only 3 days left to finish it if he wants to get his big prize, which is the sun and the moon and the goddess Freya, and the gods don't really want to pay up. They want to break their oath, and so they call in Loki, and Loki turns himself. Loki was a shapeshifter. He could be a fish, he could be a horse, he could be a bird. So he turns himself into this mare and he leads off the stallion. And you have this wonderful image of, you know, the mare and the stallion running, you know, through Iceland with the giant running after them, trying to catch the horse and saying, no, you've got to haul rocks for me.
And we have a ribaldry running across.
We have a lot of that. But then at the end, Loki has a foal. He is a pregnant horse. So he gives birth to the foal, and the foal becomes, it has eight legs, and it is Odin's great horse, Sleipnir, who's the fastest horse, the best horse of gods and men. So you have, you know, that kind of, I mean, to be called a mare was probably the worst insult you could level at a man in 13th century Iceland.
I suppose. But out of that comes the eight-legged horse that's all over the runes and looks pretty great, and Odin himself rides.
There you go. Right. And you make up that story about it. So that's, and Snorri is the only source that we have for this story. And it's one of the classic, classic Norse tales.
Let me go to Jeffrey in Warren, Rhode Island. Jeffrey, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to point out that the word Viking, strictly speaking, means pirate. Most of the Icelandic chieftains we read about in the sagas are ranchers, and they're really quite irritated by Vikings who come back from their plundering expeditions and show off their fancy clothes and strut around.
Well, let us pick that up. Nancy, do you agree with that translation of Viking? And what about chieftains and
voyagers?
The word Viking
has been kind of redefined recently. Most scholars now are using it to talk about all the people of the Viking Age. So, for instance, when I talked about a Viking woman who voyages to America, she wasn't really there for the raping and pillaging part. So we're talking about the people of the Viking Age, and Viking has become the overall term for that. But you're absolutely right that most of the people in Iceland and ranchers, they were dairymen. Mm-hmm. Snorri himself was a dairyman. So the people in the sagas who mostly lived around the year 1000, the people in Snorri's time, the year 1200, were much more interested in their cows and their sheep and their horses and their hay fields.
You described Snorri himself coming back from Norway and with all
his
treasures and fancy garments, and the chieftains were none too pleased to see him.
Oh, exactly. He shows up with, you know, all, you know, 15 treasures. We don't really know what those were, but probably painted saddles and new weapons and jewelry and silks. And he was given a ship by the king and all this kind of stuff. And he rides back into town that wasn't really a
Iceland,
town, but it was the bishop's estate, mm-hmm. and everyone says, "You're a traitor. What did you promise the king to get all those goodies?"
And in fact, they may have been right.
It's really Snorri was quite a scoundrel. He was out for himself. He was out for money. He was out for power. He was out for land. He was out for women.
The king of Norway wanted Iceland under his under his crown.
Yes, the king of Norway wanted Iceland as one of his conquests. He'd already controlled the Orkney Islands, much of northern Scotland, and he saw no reason why these Icelanders should be off there on their island all by themselves, having essentially one of the first democracies. They had a parliamentary mm-hmm. system where there were 39 chieftains who all had equal say in the government, and they met once a year to solve all their problems. Sometimes that didn't work, but sometimes it did.
No doubt.
And the king said, look, you're the only people in Europe who don't have a king right now, and I think I'm your best choice. He actually kept that up. You know, it wasn't just a 14-year-old boy's idea.
But they didn't want a king. Snorri pictured himself maybe as a king, or at least the earl, the rep of the Norwegian king, I guess.
That's exactly where he saw his position. He said, well, if somebody's going to have to come out on top of this heap, I want to be the one. And so he made some promise to the king of Norway. And we have two different versions of the story. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, those two different versions are told by the same person. They're told by his nephew, who didn't really like him, we think. And so you can't really tell what exactly did he promise to the king. Was he just going to interfere in a lawsuit so that the Norwegian traders came out ahead of the Icelandic farmers? Or was he really going to sell his country to Norway? And if you look at how history panned out, a few years after he died, Iceland did become a colony of Norway, and someone was named the Earl. And the person who was named the Earl was the person who was responsible for killing Snorri. So it kind of sounds like, yes, he did promise this king that he would bring Iceland into the realm. It was not a good move for Iceland, but it was kind of a good move for literature because it's during that time that all of the sagas were written.
Centuries of independence brought to an end there. It comes under the crown,
exactly.
but it gets pulled up into the greater realm of Scandinavia there.
Yes, that's true.
Let's go to Jonathan in Foxborough, Massachusetts. Jonathan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you. What an interesting show. I grew up in a Norwegian household and was, of course, exposed to Hollywood depictions of Vikings, which are just dreadful, and for most of my young life. But I had a cousin, Jeffrey, who got an advanced degree in Icelandic literature and exposed me to these sagas and Snorri Sturluson. And, you know, I think that while there is emphasis on the individual and superheroes and superhuman feats, there's really the greatest sagas, I feel, talk about human nature and also community, very much community. Of course, Iceland wasn't essentially the first democracy. It was the first democracy, the all thing. And interesting aspects, I think, about the sagas are the way they go into describing society. And I'd like to hear you talk more about that, specifically about Egil's saga, which is just a wonderful piece, and other ones too, Greta's saga.
Let us pick it up. Our time is short, Jonathan, but we will. I guess, are these later sagas after Snorri, Nancy?
Well, Egil's saga is actually thought to have been written by Snorri himself.
Okay. And community in this context, we hear about conquest. What about the
one of the reasons we think that he wrote this is that the area of Iceland where Egil lived and Egil essentially ruled is exactly the same as the area that Snorri ruled a couple of hundred years later, and it seems that Snorri was creating this idea that one man could control almost a fourth of Iceland. In the person of Egil,
so that he could justify a precedent. Yeah.
His own conquest. Yeah. Exactly, wow. He wanted a precedent for this. But if you look at Egil's saga, Egil is a Viking. He does go on the raping and pillaging voyages. He works for the king of England. He is a poet. He's a very fine poet, though it's not clear whether all the poems in Egil's saga were written by Egil or whether Snorri wrote some of them himself. There's questions about that, too. He's one of the few characters in Icelandic saga who is a devotee of Odin rather than of Thor. And he is an extremely good businessman and good lawyer, exactly the way Snorri was in reality. And he was not above twisting the law to serve his own ends or to, you know, help his son out of some difficulties. And all these things are, you know, the same for Snorri himself. And so you can see as you read the saga how it is very autobiographical, if Snorri indeed was the writer. And Self-aggrandizing is the perfect word for it, yes. Because Egil was considered to be a great hero. He was one of the founders first settlers of Iceland, his father was, and this was the way Iceland was established, was by this, these groups of great men. The chieftains met and talked about things and agreed on things. And it wasn't really a democracy because there was no one man, one vote.
Yeah,
the chieftains appointed themselves.
Right,
but
at least it wasn't just
one man period.
You've got pictures,
exactly.
Photographs.
Was it one man period? And they did do a lot of negotiation, and the way. The way the women worked into the society was very interesting. They had a lot more power than they did in other parts of the world. So it is indeed an extremely interesting society to look into, and the sagas tell us an awful lot about that. But I was looking more at, Snorri's version of the world, and he only really wrote this one saga that we can think of, and there's a lot of mythology in it, too.
His home still there. You have photographs of his home.
His home is still there, yes.
Bathing pool and tunnel and spiral stair.
Exactly.
He died ignominiously in his own cellar, cringing under an attack, not with the broadsword held aloft in the style of his saga's heroes.
It's quite sad. He really was a bit of a coward. And he had had a number of sort of blows. His son and heir died in a drunken brawl in Norway, And then one of his daughters died of sickness, and another daughter moved as far away in Iceland as she could get from him and really wasn't going to speak with him anymore because he kept marrying them off to very unsuitable people for political reasons. But what really kind of ended his hopes of becoming Earl of Iceland or King of Iceland was when his partner, he'd never married her, but they lived together for many years, his partner, who was the richest woman in Iceland, died suddenly. And she was 20 years younger than he was, and this just really took the heart out of him.
Hey, Nancy, name a translation that you recommend. People are asking online.
I would go with Anthony Faulx.
F-O-X?
F-A-U-L-K-E-S.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
He did the best translation of the Edda because he translated the whole thing, and usually we only get the mythological parts.
Anthony Faulx for the Edda from Snorri. Yeah. Nancy Brown's book is Song of the Vikings, Snorri, and the Making of Norse Myths. We'll go out with one more nod to Tolkien here in the film. Nancy, thank you so very much for being with
us today.
Thank
you, Tom. This was really fun.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.